what is really at your core. And I think a lot of people are afraid that they don't have anything at their core. That, you know, that we fill ourselves with distractions for fear that there's no authentic Laura. There's just weirdness or emptiness, and there's a despair that comes with that. But I think,
or it's already been traded away for momentary pleasures,
or maybe yeah. But I think
and one doesn't want to face the decisions one's made in the past, so one needs to continue
sometimes,
distracting oneself.
Yeah. Oh, feeling overwhelmed. I mean, there are all kinds of good reasons to distract ourselves. But I think a lot of it, I'm going to be kind of an optimist here. I think that even if your strength and your authentic self hasn't come out for a while, I think it's still there. I mean, sometimes we have been so distracted and so busy with nonsense that we have completely forgotten who else we are or could be, and then we're afraid it's not there. And I think it actually is there, and we have to go back to kind of peeling back the layers to find that authentic self again underneath all the junk we've collected along the way.
So I wonder whether, and this could be a potent topic, wonder whether substances, drugs, mm-hmm. even caffeine, and other types of drugs, recreational drugs and so on, can they possibly be a vehicle toward finding the authentic self, or are they distractions?
Oh, that's a good question.
Like, what about, let's talk about something that's acceptable, we all do, caffeine, coffee. I drink coffee sometimes. I'm undecided whether that helps me or distracts me.
I would frame it that there's a certain level of functioning that's required. That if your brain is too sluggish or suffering from a clinical depression, or, you know, there are things that will interfere with our brain being able to concentrate and latch on to a lot of things.
Physical things.
Well, I mean, being able to reach that state of calmness, to get to a place of authenticity is hard if, while I'm calming down, I fall asleep. So at that level, I need the caffeine.
So the caffeine is clearly, indisputably, a physical thing. It's
yeah.
a material
oh, yeah.
thing. So are you conceding that the mind is material?
I'm saying that...
In other words, a material thing can alter your mind?
Oh, absolutely.
But I guess that, I mean,
there's all kinds of evidence.
Well, according
about
to
that,
philosophy of mind, that doesn't prove your mind is material, but it certainly proves.
But certainly, there are material effects.
There's a causal relationship.
But my point, yeah. as you're distracting into metaphysics,
sorry,
my
we have to
point,
get back to happiness,
sir, is that
I think that's my destiny.
Yeah,
that's my niche in philosophy.
That's your addiction.
Not to be happy, but to be metaphysical.
But to be metaphysical,
right?
But this is it. I think that a chemical can clear some things out of our way, so that if you're in a bad place, and the chemical will help relieve some of that so that you can go forward, then it may help. But most chemical stimulants stimulate us too much, and most chemical depressants slow us down too much, and any kind of intoxicant kind of creates an artificial reality for us.
What about food?
Some foods have, yeah, chocolate.
Doesn't food have chemicals in it?
Absolutely, but
nourishment. Your brain's not going to work if you don't eat.
Proper nourishment is essential.
Yeah.
Too much sugar can jazz you too much and you can't focus. There's that, I'm going to say that there's a level of some basic level of physical health and well-being, physical and mental functioning. Without that, it's just hard to go deep. You're just kind of struggling to get through the day. And that, you know, sometimes that's all we're actually able to do. It's just getting through the day is hard enough. And you know, doing anything, looking for one's true authentic self is going to have to wait until you feel better. But I think that as long as we're reasonably functional, we tend to distract ourselves or dull ourselves to avoid thinking about things we don't want to think about. We get ourselves, if not distracted with something, then intoxicated with something. If you're not comfortable in a place of, really digging into who you are and what matters really to you, to find that level of authenticity. If that's not a comfortable space, there are all kinds of ways we can paper over it and run away from it, either by slowing down so much that we can't do it, or by jazzing up so much that we can't, you know, slow down enough to focus. And so
I've learned, by the way, as it might interest you because you're a professor, so from my student's perspective, might interest you to know that over the last couple of years, I've learned from experience that I can be most effective in my studying and my essay writing and so on. I can absorb the most when I read. I can be most productive as a student if I take the time to do what you're saying and to kind of get quiet, to
Absolutely.
Find myself, to get connected with myself, even if that means devoting part of my time, which I might think mathematically I should be devoting to studies. It's worth the sacrifice to take part of the day, even when I'm under pressure, even when I have a final exam coming up or an essay due. It actually is worthwhile for me to take part
Absolutely.
Of the day, go bike riding, go hiking, whatever.
Yeah, the yoga class, the meditation. Well, and this is it. That
I'm more productive in the remaining time.
And this is because our brain waves operate at different cycles. And if you're in the excited, having, you know, taking stuff in, having adventures, alpha waves, then you're not going to be able to focus. If you're in delta waves, it means you're sleeping and you're not going to be able to get any work done. But if you can get yourself into a good beta wave rhythm, then, okay, this is where learning and creativity happen. There's a slightly different brain wave to get into the artistic and more spiritual sides. And so, yeah, this is exactly right, that we can, there are practices that we can do, as well as chemicals, that can change how the brain actually is functioning. And a different level of brain, the brainwave cycling, will change where you're able to take your thoughts, what you're able to either to learn or to create or whatever.
If I get up in the morning and do at least an hour of a very vigorous exercise, that will give me the focus and the sort of the mental power for the pretty much the rest of the day.
Yeah.
To write an essay or to study and really absorb the material.
Yeah, it reminded me of a quote from the Dalai Lama that I love, that he was doing a multi-city tour and had a whole like early morning to late night meetings and dignitaries, and so he told his support staff that he was going to go meditate for an hour, and they said, you can't spend an hour meditating, you have such a busy day. And he said, it's because I have such a busy day that I need to spend an hour meditating.
Right.
And that's it. We sometimes have to work at finding ourselves. And so this is where the kind of experience that Catherine described pulls us pretty quickly into that other frame of mind, if you will. Other times we have to kind of work at pulling ourselves away from the distractions to be able to focus on something that deserves our attention. And but whatever the mechanism is to get from where I am now to that richer state, whether it's thinking or feeling in some way, but reaching that level of authenticity and deeper engagement with the stronger piece of myself, whatever mechanism works, go for it. Some days are harder than others to get there. And
so what techniques do you have? Describe one of your techniques. That
yoga really helps for me.
Do you go to a class at a studio, or do you do it on your own?
I did until I broke my arm. And I'm having a lot of just pain. So I'm having trouble with that now, which annoys me. My dogs will sometimes really pull me out of whatever I'm frittering about and just get down to, this is just sweetness and
you mean like go out walking with the dogs or
just a cuddle, even more than the walk, just the cuddle that there's this little creature my 15-year-old dog, I think she's having doggy dementia these days. And in the evenings, she gets really kind of distressed. She's kind of up and down and back and forth, and she'll step off the porch and kind of forget where the steps are, and you sometimes have to go fetch her and kind of show her the way to the door or the stairs or something. And she's better during the day, but at nights are kind of hard for her.
How do you feel when you're lecturing? Is that
the university? That is charged.
Does that give you a kind of happiness?
Absolutely.
Right.
So it's interesting. Yeah, those two things together. That just putting my arms around my old, confused, frightened dog. It's like I have to calm down to be able to calm her down. And when I can connect with her to be able to help her through this, that really brings me back to something. There's something really basic and primal about those connections and relationships. With teaching, my energy level is really high. I'm on. And yet there's a more kind of exuberant joyfulness of that the ideas are flowing, the conversation is going, and the thing that really gets me is watching somebody's eyes light up. The idea that they had never considered, and they go, ooh. And Catherine is so good at that. I love Catherine's face. That she'll just reflect, that's really interesting, or I never thought about that, or that's puzzling, or tell me more, or something. And it's just, I love that, getting the feedback from somebody that something connected and got through, and it might actually be interesting or useful or important for them. And that feels great for me. It's like it makes all of that time and effort to learn and prepare this stuff, it makes it all worthwhile. And again, for me, a really big part, I guess what I'm, a lot of what I'm saying has to do with connection with somebody who isn't me. That there's something really strong that me and my pleasures, that's all lovely.
So what's your experience when you get a student like me who is slightly different than one you just described? Rather than saying, oh, tell me more, I'm like, wait a minute, there's something wrong with, I don't agree with what you're saying. I automatically want to critique. Right.
Yeah. So you challenge me to rise to that standard and respond. a couple of times you challenge my patience, but that's part of the package. And yet, there are times, if I were not also getting something out of that conversation, I would not have stayed so long to have those conversations after pretty much every class. Right? I mean, I could have told you I have to go away, stop bothering me.
Right, so engaging is the other side of the coin.
Yeah.
Whereas if you weren't interested at all, you would just cut off the conversation.
Well, but not even not interested. It's more, I see a possibility that here's another human being who's really thinking about stuff. And maybe not going the direction I intended to go, probably never really going to agree with me, but that's not what's important here. But I have a student who is in love with this, and that's exciting to watch. Here I have a student who's really down in the dust wrestling. And I don't know where you're going to end up with that, but it's really exciting to see somebody get excited and passionate about it.
I can tell you now, but a couple of years later, that where I got was to a place of incredible understanding of what your position was and what you taught. Because of the fact that I was always trying to argue against it, I really learned, in order to argue against it, I had to learn what it was that I was arguing against.
And I pushed you
to
argue
against it. And I tried to come up with every possible argument, right?
Yep.
But so I often take your side of it when I'm arguing with others, you're taking what my side was.
Yeah. And this is the thing that, and again, philosophy is the journey and the dialogue, right? If the people who come to philosophy saying, I'm finding the answer, I'm figuring it all out, and that's it, the conversation is done. Man, you're just missing the joy that's possible here. And so the longer I've done this, the older I get, the more that I have kind of abandoned positions that I thought I had, or conclusions I thought I had reached. And there are some that are more kind of practical problem-solving conclusions in ethics that you know, there are just some things that fall apart in practice when you try to do them, although it's a really good idea. But in, especially with metaphysics and epistemology, I'm happier just to explore for the sake of exploring without having to feel so committed to defending a position.
You said epistemology. Can we talk about it a little bit?
Oh, honey, my brain is so tired. We can try.
Do you have knowledge of that?
Oh, you know what? This is a level beyond knowledge. This is simply innate, infused awareness.
It's intuition.
Oh, no, it's just, no. Well, you tell me, are my eyes pointed the same direction?
Well, it wouldn't be intuitive for me. For me, it would be an observation.
Well, it's more an observation, yeah. It's a struggle for me to string words together. You realize this.
Well, you're doing well.
I'm hanging in there. Yeah, that chocolate kicked in. But yeah, it's been a long day.
Well, I've gotten happiness out of epistemology. I didn't think I would. One thing I've discovered
is
that...
Oh, no, see, I would have expected you would love a lot of it. Yeah,
I've been able to think quite clearly about some epistemological.
Yeah, and this is the thing that what is so wonderful, and again, this is the part that I love best about teaching, is that you didn't even know that there's this whole set of questions out there that you would actually like to go play with, and whether you spend a lot of time there or a little time or, you know, give it up after the first class that you had in it, but simply finding out that there's something interesting out there that you didn't know about, and now you've touched it, and it's kind of cool, and you're enjoying that. That's amazing.
Well, was there anything different about me than your run-of-the-mill, lower-level student who, you know, a little bit
okay,
older.
Okay, not lower level,
older.
Introductory level.
Okay, introductory level, right.
Yeah.
Right. Who, you know, a little bit, a mature student who, like in my case, grew up in and went to, you know, through my schooling and high school and all that in a period of time when the idea of cultural relativism and tolerance for other viewpoints, this sort of rejection of objective moral standards was very popular. It was very popular to question what we were taught, and it was very popular to be tolerant. It was the Vietnam, after the Vietnam
and
War.
And don't trust
era,
anybody
right?
over 30 and
right. But after the Vietnam War,
fight authority. Yep.
We had, you know, I grew up in the U.S., and we had no right anymore to assert superiority. Moral superiority over anyone in the world. It was all about at that point.
Well, okay, but you grew up on the West Coast. I grew up in Indiana, and let me tell you, there was a right and wrong and a moral authority. The Bible Belt did not give up a stitch.
Okay.
So that's part of it.
Well, where I grew up.
Where you grew up.
Where I grew up.
Yeah, you were
very fashionable to deny that there was anything superior or better about the West or America. Because after all, we had been proven wrong.
Yeah,
and so
what I would say is, what was kind of unique was that cultural package that you brought was actually kind of a unique culture of its own, even in the U.S., let alone globally. You know, the West Coast in the 60s and 70s was different from even a lot of the rest of the U.S.
That's true.
But having said that, what's very typical of an introductory level student is you come in with what you come in with, but it may be kind of not fully formed or sort of uncritical. So to say, you know, that rejection of the authority at face value means it's all gone to the wind. A more refined approach to this is I'm not accepting it simply because it came from an authority. I'm asking, why would somebody say that or conclude that? Do they actually have a good idea? And I might accept it or I might reject it, but I'm not going to swallow it simply because it came from an authority. I'm not going to assume I'm right simply because it came from me. I'm going to look for the best answers I can find. And so that's where that critical thinking growth comes. So that for an introductory level philosophy student, it's, and I've been through this a bunch of times myself in my student career, that, you know, I thought I had something figured out, and when I'm proven to be incorrect, then I feel like it's all gone to pieces. It's all abandoned. And that's a perfectly typical reaction, but also not a really helpful one. And but it's getting to the stage beyond right. that of, is that what was worth keeping in the thing I had before? Is there anything worth keeping, or was I completely misguided? Of the things that showed me this wasn't right, what else is there then?
Well, you know what? You may already know this, but in a nutshell, the experience that I had was sort of traumatic for me in your class, because my first impulse at the beginning was to reject out of hand, as ethnocentric,
mm-hmm.
your claims that there's a such thing as universalizable moral standards that exist.
But again, some of this was, did you get how I was defining something? Universalizable in the sense that it makes sense to somebody, not me, that reasonable people looking at the same inputs could plausibly come up with the same answer. Or that, you know, ethics is not about I get to do what I want and you guys all have to follow the rules, but I get exceptions. That's
right.
That's what universalizable means. Not that absolutely everybody has to do exactly the same thing. That's, some people have come up with that, but that's actually a minority right. position right. within ethics.
Right. Right.
So, yeah, so part of where some of, you know, the points where I would get frustrated would be, you're attacking the wrong definition.
Right.
And so there is this other thing that you don't yet know about, and you're throwing that baby out with the bathwater.
Right.
And so I'm willing to throw out the bathwater too, but then, you know, you don't even know about the baby yet. I want to show you where the baby is and then let you consider what to do about that.
But what
and
I
that
was hearing,
that was the part where
what I was hearing
where
was
we ran.
That you were claiming that there are objective moral standards which transcend cultural and national boundaries that any, as you just said, any reasonable person would recognize, whether or not one adheres to them, and acknowledging that there's variations in interpretations and
yeah.
implementations,
and also people who ignore it completely to go do something else. There's that.
Right. So so my first impulse is to reject that claim as ethnocentric, that we're taking moral standards that we have in our particular
okay,
culture.
Okay, but Michael, yeah. we're back to okay. Show
no,
me.
I'm not making that argument now.
I know, right. but again, it comes down to show me the culture where death is unimportant.
Right. So I'm saying, but I'm just saying that was my initial impulse.
Yeah.
But then I realized, yeah. with your help, I realized that if I took that position, I'm in a pretty shaky ground to condemn abhorrent and obviously immoral practices like Nazism or other
mm-hmm.
genocide and, you know, infanticide and other
yeah,
things.
How can,
how can you claim that those things are wrong, well, if you're at the same time saying that there's no such thing as objective moral standards?
And so I'm going to come back to, rather than labels and categories, oh, yikes, we only have 5 minutes.
Yeah.
Something like, you know, what can we reclaim from the ethical relativism and the tolerance and the political correctness. And for me, it keeps coming down to kindness, right? Saying that there's this list of rules you're supposed to follow or the list of words you're not supposed to say. That most of that seems arbitrary, and who came up with the list anyway? Underneath that, there's something more basic about, you know, you and I have this short time on this planet, and we feel fragile, and we feel lonely, and we need help, and how are you and I gonna muddle through this crazy world together? And so if there are things that one of us does to the other that get in the way of the cooperation or that cause injury, or if there are things that I say that feel insulting and excluding to you, even if that's not what I meant, then that's where the problem comes. And it's not political correctness for the sake of political correctness. It's not embracing anything and everything for the sake of it. It's rather saying there really are some good, fundamental, pretty universal things, which is we're all just trying to make it through the day. And so are there things that we can do that make that better and easier with each other? Or are there things that we can do that hurt each other? and hurting each other, things tend to go badly. So I vote in favor not of having the list of things you're supposed to think or say or do, but rather reflect on how are the things that I'm thinking and saying and doing influencing what's going on around here? How are other people being affected by that? And is this my better, authentic self coming out? Or am I attacking because I want to be right? Am I, what is this? Where's this coming from?
Using one's rationality to sort of weigh the costs and consequences and look at the stakeholders and what people have to gain and lose and make a decision, a rational decision, rather than just blindly following a rule.
Exactly. Yeah. Blind adherence to any rule is probably dangerous.
Right.
And so, there are some pretty good rules that have shown themselves in various ways to make sense or to lead to better outcomes or to restrain the amount of damage being done. Okay, but they are always open to question. They should be.
Are you utilitarian?
Not usually.
It almost sounds like you're talking about like rule utilitarianism.
No, not usually.
Versus act utilitarianism.
No, but there are things that I do often think in a policy level, but then there's the moment to moment, minute to minute, my real authentic self wants to make it through the day, and I really could use your support doing that. And I bet you could use my support to get through your day. So how do I bring my better self out in this moment with you?
You're not a psychological egoist.
No. It's too lonely, too scary.
That's another topic. We have some in the world. We got to go. Thank you, Dr. Laura Shanner.
This has been a happy evening. Thank you.
Hope to have you back again soon.
I'm Michael Kadetz.
This has been Spring Forward, the Vancouver Island University Philosophy Radio Show from Nanaimo, British Columbia.
You have been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. This edition was originally recorded on the 27th of July, 2017.
Well, I
can
you introduce
yourself?
We'll start doing about the world we do.
Can we do this as another need?
If you really want it, you're going to make time for it.
Okay.
Could you introduce yourself?
In the language?
Yeah.
In the language?
Yeah.